This is Dimitri Martin talking, and you're hearing my advice on and in relation to showbizmonkeys.com. Around this town, I'm all right. Around this town, I'm all right. I mean, no consequence when you playing with the fire. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
How are you doing?
I got in from Denver High Plains Comedy Festival early yesterday. My bag is still packed from that. I have to unpack it and then repack it because I fly to Toronto tomorrow. So
you're originally from Ottawa, right?
Yeah.
As a comedian, I just want to ask off the top, why is Ottawa such an amazing comedy city? Because the crowds there are wild and hungry for comedy in a way I've never seen before, and I've confirmed with other comics.
I think you're talking specifically about Absolute Comedy as a club.
Okay, that was my experience. I didn't know that that was specific.
It's very specific to that space. If you were to send in a tape, I don't know if this still is the case, but there was a time when I was coming up in Canada where if you were to send in an audition tape and it had the Absolute logo in the background, the tape was not submissible because it's like cheating a bit. Anyone can do well on that stage.
Really?
Yes. Yes. I find that the other I think that Yuck Yucks is a great comedy club in Ottawa. Howard Wegman's my guy. That's like a more honest stage, but a great stage. Great crowds are there too. And there's a new club downtown in the market that I can't remember the name of, but I heard it's good as well. But the reason why, if you're wondering, Absolute is good, is because, and this happens to a lot of stages that are put together by former failed comedians, which is what the Jason guy is who runs Absolute, is they do the lighting, the stage position in the room, the ceiling height, the color of the room being dark enough, and the sound properly. And they seat the audience properly, close together.
Right.
Laughter is contagious, and all of those elements combine for a better room. But 98 out of 100 times, people who design stand-up stages do not consult or believe stand-up comedians. They don't believe we know what we're talking about, even though we do it for a living. Crowds are different in different places because of the way a room is set up. We are animals. Laughter is contagious. Mm-hmm. Cannot have high ceilings. The sound needs to bounce back. The audience cannot be lit up because people don't laugh if they feel like they are not anonymous, because it's a vulnerable thing. They need to be seated close together because laughter is contagious. They cannot be seated sparsely in the back. If you have a 150 seat room and there's only 50 people there, you need a curtain, and you need people to be seated closer to the stage. Even if they don't want to, you have to force them. Then you have to close a curtain behind them. And that room is perfectly set up with all those elements. The stage has to be in the middle of the room. It can't be like a movie theater, like a long, skinny movie theater where the stage is at the front. The stage has to be in the middle, always in the middle. You have to have an equal amount of people on your right. If you're standing on stage, you have to have an equal amount of people on your right side and on your left side. You can't have more on your right, or you can't have most of them in front of you and a little on your right, a little on your left. If most of the people are in front of you, it will not be as good a room, because the people in the back will feel like they're watching on TV, like they're disconnected. And that is the reason why Absolute is really good. He is a failed comedian, so he knows what it's like to be up there.
That's incredible. The comedian Todd Glass is also known for that. He has very specific ideas. Have you ever done Comedy Bar before?
I have definitely done Comedy Bar multiple times, yeah.
the main room is narrow like a movie theater.
Yes. Yes. And it is not as great a room as it could be. And every comedian will tell you that. It is good for, you know, sketch. It's good for sketch. Mm-hmm. Sketch is different. It's more of like a theater. The owner of that room, great guy, funny guy as well. Mm-hmm. And really a steward, a great steward of the comedy community has helped me out. He will probably tell you that too. But that's the way the building is. Like it's a little too narrow. I would like to see the stage in the middle, but it's like built on a slope. Like the way that it's done it would be really tough to, it would be expensive too. But right. I think that, you know, you'd have to reconfigure the whole space.
Well, but it's interesting because the last time Todd Glass performed there, he left like a list of demands of like what he would change and how he would fix from the green room to the lighting in the main areas and beforehand. Yes. And I just love to hear your opinion on like how it's changed. It is still a movie theater aisle.
Yeah, I would move the wall. I'd make it a little wider. I would take the grade out. I believe it's on a grade. Mm-hmm. And I would take the grade out and I would put the stage in the middle. I mean, that would make it a better stand-up room for sure. Even if there was only like four rows in front of you and then most people on your right and left, it would just make a much better stand-up room. But then you'd have to move the bar back on the other side of the wall.
Right.
What's great about that is the bar is in a different room. Mm-hmm. You cannot have the bar in the same room. And if you do, you can't have any mixed drinks. You can't have any like shaking going on.
Yes.
It's 100%. So loud. It's so crazy. Yeah, another thing that Absolute does really well, and most clubs, professional clubs do this, but new clubs don't, is the staff has to whisper. And then if the drunk person's like in the middle of a show, people will go like, "I'll have two Bud Lights and one margarita." Mm-hmm. And they gotta be like, "Shh, where is the show?" And they go, "Oh, I'm sorry. I'll have two Bud Lights and a margarita myself because I have a huge problem."
Right. And then of course, when you're trying to do your closer, but that's when they come out with like the debit machines to settle up the bill. I feel like a lot of comedy clubs have changed that.
Yeah, I don't know if Absolute does, but they do it. A lot of the comedy clubs do it after. They do it when you're done, and then they drop the checks. In New York, where I live, they have something called a check spot. So what they do is most New York clubs are showcase style, meaning they don't have a headliner at the end doing 45 minutes to an hour. They have five or six comedians doing 12 to 15 minutes. And they have a host bringing everybody up, and that's the show. Hour and a half, bing, bang, boom. But they drop the checks at the tail end of the show. Before the last person goes up, paid comic, they have a newer comic come up and do a check spot. It's called eating the checks. They get like a new guy who's trying to break in, or girl, or they... to break into the club, and you just basically bomb while drunk people are doing math in front.
Yeah, that sounds brutal.
Yeah, but it makes you strong.
Yeah,
like if you can kill on a check spot, the manager will notice. Other comics will notice for sure.
Yeah,
and if you're listening, if you're a comedian and you ever have to do checks, just focus on, because the crowd's not all going to get their checks at the same time. Some will be done before others. Some won't have them yet. Focus on the 15 people who are looking at you they're all usually clumped together because it happens in a wave, and just kill with them. And if you start killing, the people doing the math are going to get distracted and go, "What's he talking about?" And then you'll all of a sudden have the whole, by then you'll have the whole room and the checks won't be done. And that means that you won.
No, that's great advice. I actually think I remember hearing Bob Dylan say the same thing about look at the people who are looking at you. I wonder if he was also dealing with checks. Probably. Maybe. Probably. But
yeah. I hope Bob Dylan didn't have to deal with a check spot. There, if he did, there's no hope for humanity.
Yeah. To kind of segue, because I want to talk about the show that you're doing now, which is about your relationship with your brother who has autism. It's kind of interesting because going through all of your old clips and your most recent special, the one in the bowling alley, you are so proficient at writing jokes.
Oh, thank you.
Some would say the Bob Dylan of writing that.
Don't say that.
Yeah. That I would argue that, like,
I'm the Raffy of jokes, of writing jokes.
I have a friend whose mom used to open for Raffy and really telling stories at school. Apparently, he was just like, I'm in it for the money. I'm going to get the check and I'm out.
Yes.
And that's,
yes.
I think he's in Germany, Sweden, somewhere.
Yeah, he runs like a sex club.
Yeah, he yeah. has banana phone money. He doesn't need anybody.
I love that Raffy T coming on Entertainment Monkeys.
Yeah.
That's what you tune in for. Child entertainer T from 1989.
Oh, I have Fred Penner stories. My best friend, like, grew up next door to Fred Penner.
Yeah.
And amazing Frisbee player. That's what that I'll say sense. That won't get me sued.
Oh, there's other stuff.
There's a bunch of stuff I could off the record.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, sweet. We're going to be friends.
But what I was going to say is that you're so proficient at writing jokes that I would think you almost like make a choice to be personal. Like you don't have to. Sort of like, I love Stephen Wright. I don't think I actually know anything about Stephen Wright.
No. No. But can't you picture him in like a ripped flannel in like Vermont, drinking hot tea in the morning, just looking at a snowy field going,
Yeah.
The Hawks back today. I'm pretty sure that's just it.
Life. Maybe he's chopped some wood before then.
Yeah, yeah.
But only as a reflective exercise on self-meditation.
Yeah.
He's the Walt Whitman of Bob Dylan's of stand-up comedy.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, that tracks. Yep.
Yeah. So was this a conscious choice to like shift things and go way more personal?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I really enjoy jokes. I really enjoy joke writing. But I also think that you can watch someone, like you said, like do really well or is really good, and then you don't know anything about them. And maybe it's not as funny, but it sticks with you more. So I'm trying to evolve or find a balance. I also do believe that the more personal and specific an artist gets, the more universal it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of just trying to talk more about my life and what makes me unique as a person, my experience. And one of those things is, having a sibling with a pretty severe disability and being the only other sibling and having to take care of them growing up. And also what it means when my parents pass away, having to take care of him for the remainder of his or my life. So those are definitely specific choices I've made.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that those years of like being a joke machine have really helped, because a lot of people, they do like a one person show. I'm calling this a one person show. They it's just not as joke. It's not as funny. I think I'm able I can tell my story, but also have some solid jokes in there around the narrative arc.
Do you think it came from a place of frustration of I wish people knew this about autism, or did it come from of like, if I don't get this stuff off my chest, I'm gonna lose it?
I think the latter, but I also think that in doing that, you unearth feelings from your childhood before you repress them, mm-hmm. where you're like, why don't people understand he has a disability? Why are they being mean to him? And why are they being weird and I'm embarrassed? Why am I embarrassed? Why am I like a, you know, 9 years old and being like, I hope he doesn't do this today at the grocery store. It should be like, he's going to do this and they're going to know, you know, it's, and I think, I don't know. I have a podcast about autism awareness. Mm-hmm. I do with my podcast partner, Kirk Smith. He has a non-verbal son, an adult son. And in doing that, we, in the past 7 years since we've been doing it, we have seen and in a small part contributed to the public being more aware, which I think is a good thing. I do think we're headed right. in the right direction. So I think that, but I think that this show that I'm going to do that we're talking about right now, this Pete and Me show, also helps with that. I also think it's like help the parents on the plane.
Yeah.
You know? They don't want their kid to be screaming, but they have to travel. That, trust me, this isn't a vacation. This kid doesn't want to go,
mm-hmm.
but they have to travel for whatever reason. Help the kid. If he's screaming for 3 hours, that's not the parent's fault. It's not the kid's fault. It's just life. It's just life. So you only have to deal with it for 3 hours. Okay. Yeah. This dad has to deal with it his whole life. So this is a reminder that you're lucky. So shut up. Don't yell at this kid. Don't yell at the dad. Don't be like, control your kid. Maybe think, oh, this kid has autism. I'm lucky. I'm lucky I know how to count. I'm yeah. lucky I can say I love you.
It is such a weird thing that you would have to feel, or you don't actually have to feel embarrassed, but it's just like, no, you should have basic human empathy and understanding of the situation.
Yeah, people don't. A lot of people don't. Most people do, but I would like it to be so far that not, you know, instead of having, right now we have most people on the plane going, oh, that's too bad. I guess this is life. And they just ignore it. And then you have one or two or three people going, control your kid. I would like it to go even further where the other 97 out of 100 people shout down those three people and protect this kid and the dad.
Yeah, I mean, I know other comedians on the spectrum. I've taught a lot of different kids on the spectrum. And I think the thing I found is that most people don't realize is how wide of a spectrum it is.
Yeah, I always take that for granted. And it's one of the things I had to incorporate into my show is that not everybody knows the width of the spectrum for sure. You know, they had, you know, Asperger's was a thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's like very high functioning people. People who, you know, who go to university, get a job, but aren't the best in social situations. And then the name Asperger got taken away and incorporated back into regular autism because they found out he was a huge Nazi. But I would like if they just had a new name, because those people do get looped in and people talk to them like, like they have a huge disability, but really they don't. They're just neurodivergent and they're excellent problem solvers for society to have because they think differently. And my brother is not like that. He literally can't count past like 13. Doesn't mean he's any less of a human being, though. He also contributes to society in a different way. He raises empathy and whatnot. Also, my podcast partner, Kirk's son, is, I would say, on the other opposite end of the spectrum. My brother might be somewhere in the middle where Kirk's son can't talk, can't say I love you, can't say I hurt my foot. You know, he's 21. He just started using the bathroom regularly, going to the toilet, not in his pants. And like, that's also something that's different, you know, so that if someone goes to college and has a job, that's very different.
Yeah.
You know,
because it's such a wide spectrum, have you gotten a lot of feedback from the autistic community in doing the show?
I get a lot of feedback from parents and siblings. That's who the shows are for. So that's who I get the most of the feedback from. I get some people come to the show and they go like, I have autism. I just want to see what I'm putting my brother through, or what I put him through when he was a kid. Like jokingly, they'll say
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And that's hilarious and awesome. But yeah, it's mostly parents and siblings who are, I've also had parents bring their teenage child who is not on the spectrum, but has a sibling on the spectrum to the show, you know, and they all come up to me after and are like, you're a bad man. Why'd you do that? No, I'm kidding. It's an emotional thing. People appreciate it. And you realize that there's no outlet or there's no one talking about what it means, how it affects you as a kid, how it affects your personality as an adult, how it affects your future as an adult. Mm-hmm. It also brings to light that there is no support for a lot of these people once they turn 21. It falls back on the family. So even though, like I said, the reason why I did this is to get it off my chest, it's one of the other things that's good that comes out of a show like this, is it brings to light that maybe it's not the best system when we just discard them after a certain age, an arbitrary age that would mean something for a neurotypical person, but not for an atypical person. And even if you are higher on the spectrum or higher, I don't know if people don't want to say higher or lower, but if you are more functional on the spectrum and you are capable of going to university and getting a job, maybe you need more time anyway.
Right.
Maybe it should be 25 or something, you know? Anyway.
100%. I guess I'm also just wondering, well, there's a couple ways I could go at this, but like, are there things that you're doing specifically to make it easier for that audience to take in? Because like, I'm bipolar and trying to do a lot of that material on stage can be like hit or miss with some audiences, or I get people after shows, they're like, you function very well, or
and you just pull out a knife.
Yeah. Like, oh, I'm switching to the other one.
I'll show you.
But even like, I've seen comedians go up and do breakup material, and like the audience feels too bad for them to laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
So like, is there anything in your arsenal right now that you use to structure the show?
Not really. I mean, I just think a lot of that has to do with ability as a stand-up and time put in. After a while, you kind of know, like, if I say this around my friends, they'll all laugh, but if I say this around the audience, 30% will go, aw.
Yeah,
you could be talking about like a make-believe talking moose that gets run over by a car, and there'll be some stupid lady going, aw, it's a make-believe moose. You don't have to have empathy for this make-believe moose,
right?
You know what I mean? So it's like I can't think of any specific examples, but there are ways to kind of nip that at the bud before you get into it, or if you do know that someone's going to go ah, or a few people are going to go ah, then you can have like a line to like go like it's a make believe moose person. Who went,
Well, you described it as more of a one-man show. How did you start workshopping it? Was it still in comedy clubs, or did you have to go to like black box theaters in New York?
Yeah, definitely. It's one of the advantages of living in New York, living here, is that there's like a bunch of smaller theaters you can workshop it on. I was going to go to Edinburgh. It's a big fringe festival. It's the biggest fringe festival in the world. And a lot of people bring their new shows there. And they have to spend all of August doing like 3 shows a day. You know, you put yourself up in a hotel. Most people lose money. Then you come back, but you have like a polished show. But then that makes sense if you live in a smaller market. And I'm like, I don't want to fly to Scotland to get a good review from the Scotsman or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I live in New York City, so I'm just going to do it here. I know a really good small theater in Queens called QED Theater that really helped me a lot. And that enabled me to get my my theater in Greenwich Village called Under St. Mark's Theater. So it's also like it's not a huge theater either. It's not like I'm on Broadway or anything, but that was the process. I had to, it enabled me to like just do it in front of smaller groups and not lose my shirt.
And I'd imagine you'd have to get used to a different kind of pacing necessarily.
Certainly, definitely. That took a long time. Different pacing than a comedy club. Different crowds, different expectations and context from the audience. A lot of my friends who were stand-ups who did like one person shows, they would tell me that they had a lot of trouble with theater audiences because the expectation and the context is different. And they were coming across as mean. And if you did the same jokes, like we would like, basically, if a comic does like a one-person show, they've done the jokey part in comedy clubs as a set. And that's what I, and it crushes. Like all those jokes, like usually they, you know, they do well. They do really well. But in some of them, when you put them in a theater context, theater audiences think that you're being mean. So you have to, again, if you're going to do something that's a little like... Like people get caught up in like, they have like a Pavlovian response. Even you could do like a anti-homophobia joke. But if you say something like, I don't know, but just say that as a straight white guy. And maybe you're pretending to be the character of a bad person.
Right.
People get caught up and they think you're the bad person. You know, they can't get past that one word and realize that you're being ironic and making fun of the bad man. And so you really in the theater audience sort of have, before you get into that section, have to set up that you are a good person. You don't want to hurt anybody and you are on the side of the good. And then you can get into that section where you are going to make fun of the bad person. And then that you have to learn in certain parts to really not baby them because they're just as smart as you, but they're coming into this and realize, you know, I have to understand in a different context. You have to really shepherd them to that place. If that makes any sense.
No, that makes complete sense. I won't keep you much longer. I think last two things is, how do you think growing up in your household with that living situation, do you think that developed your sense of humor?
100%. I think that like it as a coping mechanism. I think a lot of comedians, I mean, you said you do stand up, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So you're bipolar and you probably felt a little different and you probably used comedy as like an air valve to just like release pressure of the situation and how you felt and make yourself feel good and make your friends feel good. So I think that growing up in I grew up in a very chaotic environment, not only because of my brother, but you know, my parents are very, very, they're lovely people, but they're very loud. We would get kicked out of restaurants. I had really bad OCD to the point where I had to go to the hospital. I got sent to boot camp because people thought I was on drugs and I didn't want to tell them what was happening to me.
Right.
And so I think all of that, one thing I was good at and made me feel happy and special because I was bad at school. I'm dyslexic. I, you know, have like really bad ADD as well. I mean, a lot of people have those things, but I couldn't understand. I felt smart, but I was getting like 30%. 40%, 50% and everything.
Right.
And I was just failing and people would make fun of me. And the only thing that I was good at was being funny. Yeah. So I think that was like a skill that developed over time that you really kind of hone when you're developing your personality. By the time you have a personality in your mid-teens, it's sharp as a frickin' knife. And like, I'm an adult now and it's like, I'm funnier than most people. I like just in conversation, I think.
No, I mean, for me, I very much identify with the thing of chaos. And it was just, hey, if I can control the chaos this way, if I can get everyone looking at me for a sec, I can diffuse the situation or at least like settle it down or 100%. In your show, if there's one thing that you want people to take away from it, what is it?
That's a really good question. And I wish I had an answer prepared for you. But I think that the one thing I'd like people to take away from it is that there is not enough help for adults.
Yeah.
Adults with autism. And you probably don't think about it, but families are dealing with this. And it's a growing problem. More people are getting diagnosed year by year. Numbers are rising. And there's no solution. And it's better for society if we do find one.
Yeah. But, well, with all my mental illness stuff, I can't agree more.
Yeah.
Same problem, different end of it.
Sure. I hope you're doing okay.
I'm doing great now because I got into programs that exist. So,
right.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me. It was like honestly a pleasure meeting you, dude. Thank you.
I hope you have a great run at the festival. I hope everyone comes out to see the show. It's very compelling.
Thanks very much. And you have to tell me about Fred Penner.
Maybe we'll set up a paywall for people to get to know all the dirt on Fred Penner.